I think if we go back 50 years ago and you tell them this is going to happen, they're going to go, no, there is no way that that can happen. We won't allow it. Yet here we are. Once you get into it, it seems like everybody's writing a book. And gluts tend to kill markets, or at least to devalue them to the point where things just aren't worth the doing. Just because there's a lot of material out there doesn't mean that it's good material, or it's that consumable, or that consumers want it. I think we're looking at another 100 years before we get to artificial general intelligence. I see people saying things, oh, you shouldn't discriminate against something that's AI generated, and they somehow tie it in with Lieutenant Commander Data on Star Trek.
Hello, and welcome to Culturescape, the show that interviews the geek creators and influencers who built nerd culture. Our guest today is a swordswoman, author, and a former electric engineer and medical researcher. Mona Lisa Foster is the popular author of the Ravages of Honor series, and today is celebrating her latest new book, Threading the Needle, published with Simon & Schuster by Wayne of Bain Books. Today, we are going to explore Mona Lisa's journey from Romanian to American author, the inspiring works of classic science fiction that brought her, and where the science fiction genre goes from here. And for today's stupid nerd question, we will ask Mona Lisa, is Star Wars still salvageable? And if so, what would you do to save it? Welcome to the show, Mona Lisa.
Oh, thank you for the softball question on that one, Peter. I really appreciate it.
I think about this a lot. It's kind of funny. It's like a few years ago, if you said things like, oh, you know, Star Trek, Star Wars, Doctor Who, these franchises are in trouble, the MCU. You know, these could go away tomorrow. You know, something has gone broken wrong. And then it was like, oh, how could you? You hater, you terrible person. You just don't like it that there are females in Star Wars movies now. And now it's like, fast forward to 2023, and it's like everyone's like, yeah, Disney's done. It's toast. Star Wars is gone. Put it in the grave. That's it. So it's been really wild how we've gone from like in a year, 2 years maybe. From like, you can't say any of this to now everyone is saying it.
I think fixing it just probably would entail going back to the original source material. I know a lot of people who like the Timothy Zahn books that came out right after Return of the Jedi. There's a name for it. It's expanded universe. Am I thinking of the wrong franchise?
No, you're right. It's the Expand Universe. I think you're referring to the Thrawn. So yeah, the Thrawn series, which is Heir to the Empire. Yes.
Well, I remember reading those after Return of the Jedi came out. The ones where Luke falls in love, and he had a family, and a lot of my friends were bigger Star Wars geeks than I am, talk very much about why didn't they just go with that? Why did they have to change the storyline? Why did they have to do what they did with, why did they allow Kathleen Kennedy to do what she did with the IP? And I think that they're right. I think that all of those particular titles stuck with the promise of the original storyline. There was just the idea of telling a good story, of having an adventure. There were some romantic subplots. There were things that people could relate to. And instead of whatever it was that Kathleen Kennedy decided to do with, the horse is female kind of thing. And it's not that we hate female protagonists. I write female protagonists, and I love strong female protagonists like Helen Ripley from Aliens, like Lady Jessica from Dune. What they have in these franchises are not those kind of characters. They have a caricature of those characters. And I think that's very sad. I think that's one of the reasons that people can't, well, at least some people can't get into these new stories and the way that they were spun by Kennedy and other people.
Yeah, it hasn't been quite the same since Disney purchased Star Wars. Even the books themselves, they have gotten much worse. They used to be published with Del Rey, and then after Disney came in, they wanted to switch all that up. And it's like the quality of authors are coming in. They're people you never heard of. They tend to be younger, more diverse. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but they may not have much of a track record when it comes to putting out quality fiction and shows. I just think it's just been so mismanaged. There are a lot of people like, oh, this is doomed. There's no way it could come back. But I still feel like there's enough interest left. There's enough, there are embers, you know, you get the oxygen going, maybe put on some fresh wood. Maybe we could get this bonfire going again. So I don't think it's completely over, but it's going to be a heavy lift. I don't know if that means that these properties would have to get sold or what would have to happen to save it. But I still am a positive person that thinks it can happen. But I might be wrong. I hope I'm not wrong, though. I mean, it would be nice if these things would be okay. And speaking of books, that is kind of how you got to where you are today. What my viewers do not know is you are an American author, but that is not actually where you were born. You are American by way of immigrating from Romania.
Yes. So my family defected and came here about 1979, which means I was about 9 or 10 years old when we finally immigrated over. It was during the time when Ceausescu was still in power. So we were essentially refugees from communism.
Similar to Ayn Rand, she also was from Romania, though her family left before Ceausescu and the Soviets had fully got hold.
I believe she was Russian, actually.
She's officially Russian, yeah, but I believe her family was, I don't have my Ayn Rand.
I don't either.
biography in front of me.
Yeah. So, I mean, my family defected, my father defected first, and then we were allowed to leave a few years later. And one of the things that that happened was that I was the official family translator. I was designated as the person that was going to learn English and act as translator. And
a lot of pressure for a young kid.
Yeah, but that was not that unusual. I mean, one of the things about the culture there was that they didn't coddle you until you were 26. They didn't coddle you until you were 13. It was very much as soon as they felt that you were able to do anything, you were expected to fulfill that role, and a lot of it was very, very sink and swim. It's just a different, I guess, more of an old world attitude. Because they don't have the time to wait for you to decide that you have found yourself and you finally want to join the adult world and take on adult responsibilities, just pretty much aren't given a choice. But what that meant was that my mom bribed the right officials so that I would get put into a class that taught English rather than German or Russian, which were the other two things that were being pushed at the time. So I started learning English in school about first grade. And I think I was about third grade when we left. And when we came here, my father had already been here for a while, but my mom and the other part of my family wasn't. But I was still the designated translator because I knew English best. And one of the things that I did when I came here is I taught it to myself. By translating Heinlein's Juvenile from English to Romanian using a dictionary. That is how I taught myself English.
So that's so interesting. That's such a unique choice of novel to do, and that seems like a little bit difficult for someone, especially that's just trying to start out reading English.
It was something that was pushed my way by a librarian because that's where I was doing this. I would go to the library and do this on my own. And I'm not sure why the librarian decided to give me science fiction in the first place. I don't know why it was Heinlein in the first place. I'd like to think that, you know, there's some serendipity behind it looking at it now, because in a lot of ways, I think that Heinlein ended up being sort of an intellectual father for me. It was and this may have been the reason that the librarian might have done it. The idea of you as an individual, that was it's a very strong thing that runs out through all of Heinlein's work. Well, we didn't have that in Romanian culture. We were part of a collective in terms of you were part of a family first, you were part of a clan, you were part of the workers or whatever collective identity that people wanted to push at the time. And you were not allowed to be an individual. You had to suborn your individuality and what you yourself wanted in order to be accepted. And a lot of times, if you refuse, like a lot of the things that I think a lot of first worlders and Westerners in particular take for granted have to do with just being able to speak their mind without any consequences, especially when they're speaking truth to power. And it's like they can't imagine that that would not be allowed, that your family, that your clan, or a bigger group that you were part of would step in collectively and make sure that you didn't get to say what you wanted to say, that there would be consequences, not just for you, but for them. So they relied on this kind of group pressure to keep us in line. And because of that, we really didn't have identities in the same way. And those stories helped me realize that, oh, there's this individualism running through them and through the characters that I think really helped me figure out how to fit into American society.
That is such a cool influence. It's such a neat, you have a cool origin story. I like it. Hyland's great. Speaking of someone that's a bit Randian, he hasn't really been the best adaptated, in Hollywood necessarily, but his books have been a huge impact on so many people, especially those who end up writing science fiction. Hyland is one of those go-to that you pick up if you want to have a great understanding of world building and how to fully engage with that. So that's pretty cool. I do wonder though, did that play? Because on your website, my research, you worked in all sorts of industries. For a time, you were an electrical engineer at a semiconductor plant. You did medical research. Like, did this start with science fiction guide you further on? How did you end up doing stuff like that in your career?
Oh yeah, I wanted to be an astronaut. So to tell you how good I got at being assimilating into American culture, I wanted what everybody wanted in the early 80s that were my age. We wanted to go into space. We wanted to be astronauts. So if you were a geek, that was the thing you wanted to be, right? Mm-hmm. And I was no exception. And it took about 5 to 10 years to figure out that's never going to happen to me. For one thing, there was no way I could get the security clearance to do that. Remember, this is before the fall of communism. But it still put me down this path of math and science. And I'm not sure it was so much with the exact idea of where I was going to go with it, but I liked, one of the things I liked about math and science in general was the rigor of it. There was no touchy-feelingness. There was one correct answer. It was very rigid and structured. And for me, I needed that in my life at the time. And I was attracted to math and science in general. And I ended up, math was not my strength, believe it or not. Languages were. All of my tests showed I should have gone into languages, and I ended up going into mathematics instead because I was just too stubborn to take a test result and let it make that kind of decision for me. So for me, I struggled to get through some of the things, but eventually, if you put your nose to the grindstone, That's right.
Yes, I got it.
Then you can accomplish things that you didn't think you were going to do. So I ended up starting in engineering, and then I switched schools. And the school I went to had their engineering school had lost its accreditation, and there was some question about whether or not you could actually get a job based on the fact that they had lost that accreditation. So I went into physics instead. And astrophysics in particular had been one of those things that I always was interested in. So my plan was to become an astrophysicist and then, of course, an astronaut, because by this point, things had changed a little bit and you could posit the idea that somebody with my origin story would be allowed to go into space. However, life happened. That didn't quite work out. I did end up going to work for Motorola designing semiconductors. That was one of the things I did. And then I ended up in medical research completely by accident. That was something that I would have never seen in a million years. I didn't even know there was such a thing as radiation oncology. I should have, but I didn't. And it was one of those things that I kind of fell into. I was in the right place at the right time. And my background fit, because a lot of the stuff that you have in just in physics for engineering, especially having to do with radiation, ported over to what the practice that I ended up working for needed at the time, which was somebody to run their clinical research program.
That is interesting. So going into your book, your book features a person that is a cyborg. The gal has a cybernetic arm. Do you think you take any of your influence from working in semiconductors, in doing research? Did any of those influence how you write or what you like to write about?
Definitely. And there's a reason I write science fiction as opposed to fantasy or urban fantasy or romance, even though I tend to have a lot of romantic elements in my fiction. I find science fiction just to be more interesting and also more challenging to write because you have to have things make sense. And the other thing that it allows you to do is it allows you to take something and extrapolate it. So even though we have all of this technology here, I think the fun of writing science fiction is in asking, okay, well, what is next? What is going to come from it? What else can we do with this? The medical portion for Talia, again, I think, I don't know if I wouldn't have ended up in research if I would have ended up, making her a cyborg, because there was quite a learning curve going from working in semiconductors to working in the medical field. But a lot of the stuff that I learned for that job definitely figured into this. If nothing else, it just is setting the limits and making it very, very believable, because sometimes science fiction has a tendency to go over the top into kind of more fantastical things. And I tried to keep this a little bit more rigorous, a little bit more on the hard science fiction side.
That's interesting. I did an interview near the start of the year with Dr. Robert Hampson, who he's a neuroscientist, but his specialty is in implants. And in that conversation, we talked a lot about how science fiction, today kind of pulls forth the evolutions and innovations of tomorrow. Is that something you think that, there seems to be a give and take when it comes to science fiction, the love of science fiction, geek culture, where not only are people that are in the hard fields, like you were, working on semiconductors and how that inspires you to go into writing. Do you think that goes in the other direction? Or is what you're doing on authors like Hampson or Heinlein, does that in turn influence people to go and develop more?
So Robert is a friend of mine. I actually talked to him when I was preparing for this story. In fact, one of the reasons that Talia's arm runs on the Hampson effect is because I asked Rob, how did you power your cybernetics for your The Moon in the Desert, which was his book, which features a bionic protagonist who has more than one limb missing. And we talked about thermodynamics effect. He fudged it, basically. That was a speculative element because in real life, that is the limiting factors is the power, or one of the limiting factors is the power. And I thought, well, you know what? If Rob can fudge it for his hard SF novel, then I can fudge it for mine. And that is how the Hampson effect came into the book.
No, it's not how it's, that's funny. It's like, well, you know, you're an expert and you live down to this level. So why can't I, Robert? Why can't I?
Yeah. So, I mean, we like to think that we know what's coming, but we inevitably get hit with unexpected things. So you see these old nostalgic sci-fi 1950s or retro sci-fi, and you see people using quote unquote cell phones, and they're looking at one screen, and they've got this thing hanging, to look at the screen, and then they've got this big honky telephone over it. So even though we predicted cell phones, the form is completely different. Because at the time that they were making those drawings in the 1950s or those spaceships or whatever, we didn't know the things that eventually went into develop into making the technology portable, into making it possible, and to making it ubiquitous.
No, and that's more than fair. I think science fiction, that you were right, in general, that seems to be has a good idea of concepts. It's just the form factor of what they exactly will look like or how it will be used. I think one of the unfortunate things about most science fiction authors is, in a way, even the most depressing of them, they're optimists. for the most part, they see the positives or how much farther it could bring humanity and raise the bar. Unfortunately, humans being humans, they often take it and go the other direction. I mean, you only need to look at like TikTok or all the plagiarism scandals we've recently had using ChatGPT. Or, you know, as often as these technologies do live for better living, it also enables a whole lot of people to live worse.
Yeah, and I think that, I don't know, a lot of science fiction is that the future is a better place. And we get so excited about getting there and how do we get there. And a lot, oftentimes we just cannot predict. I mean, I would not have been able to predict TikTok, for example, or even ChatGPT, because especially as far as these plagiarism scandals are and what teachers are having to do in order to make sure that students actually produce something. I would not, or even a lot of the stuff with not so much the internet, but with social media and the power that it has. I think if you go back 50 years ago, somebody and you tell them this is going to happen, they're going to go, no, there is no way that that can happen. We won't allow it. Yet here we are.
I'm just old enough to remember when it was 2009, 2010. Even still going into 2011, this is when most of the discussion of things like Facebook was relatively positive, and it's really in 2011 we start to see more criticism. And the general beat was, and you'd see it all over the place in popular culture and the news, and it's like, oh, these apps, social media is making us all more connected, and isn't that such a great thing? And if you just fast forward a few years, if this is true as it was in 2017 following the presidential election, or even today, it's a completely different look. It's like, oh no, now we know too much about our neighbor. Now we're much too connected. So, but maybe these are things where it didn't have to go this direction. You know, there's that human agency factor. It's like, did TikTok have to exist? Did these negative uses of this technology have to happen, or was it a choice? That's an interesting question. Probably think about for another sci-fi novel. What is your experience so far working as a science fiction author? It is, as of late, a tough time to be in the book business. Bain is wonderful. Big fan of Bain. They helped put together the show, so always grateful to them. But not easy. Not easy. I mean, I'm on the newsy side, and it's rough. It's pretty rough out there.
Everybody seems to be writing a novel or... You know, especially once you get into it, it seems like everybody's writing a book. And gluts tend to kill markets, or at least to devalue them to the point where things just aren't worth doing. And I keep thinking that the bottom is going to fall out of it, but it's not. Okay. And I think that one of the reasons is that just because there's a lot of material out there doesn't mean that it's good material or it's that consumable or that consumers want it. The other side of it is now you can satisfy any taste at all, okay? So that kind of makes it interesting. It's just how niche do you want to get? We used to have, okay, we got the science fiction genre and the fantasy genre, but look at all of the subgenres we have now. And it kind of spreads. If you were to do a flow chart, it would just, you know, you just all those levels, and they keep adding levels and more and more sub-levels to everything. And it's gotten to the point where you almost need five or six different terms to describe certain niche genres. Now, is that good or is that bad? Because that's an honest question. I have no idea. I look at it as a writer and I go, every time I try to refine it, I'm limiting the audience that I want. Yet the audience might be growing or not. So there might have been, 10,000 science fiction consumers at one point, but now there's 10 million. So how far can you drill it down? It just makes it very challenging to decide what to write and how to write and who to write for.
It's interesting you bring this up. I don't think I'm a dedicated particular genre for science fiction reader. I'm pretty broad. I like a lot of the classical stuff. And then if I am told, oh, this person, they write something similar, that's usually what draws me in. I talked to my uncle, though, and he is super into, like, basically isekai, so, like, trapped in another universe story, or he loves hardcore military science fiction. I remember I was having this conversation with him over Thanksgiving, or talking books. He says, well, that guy's okay. He's all right because he only allows this much murder, mayhem, and adult content. But this author, he allows too much. And so it's like these super sub divides and these micro niches for books. But it seems like, you know, Bane does well for itself. Then these people who even just self-publish with Amazon, they have their little isekai novel. It seems like they're holding in there. I am curious how the economics of all that work, but that might be an issue of, like, you know, this is the real internet. You know, it's like fan fiction has been popular for, you know, ever on the internet, 20, 30 years. So, I mean, people keep coming back to this stuff. And unlike TV, movies, video games, you can survive and go on with a relatively small audience. I mean, the history of, like, science fiction in the 20th century was mostly that. Like, a little person here and there buying, you know, their copy of the magazine with, you know, a Heinlein story in it. So it's interesting. It's very similar, actually, how we've kind of gone from the days, the 30s, 40s, 50s, even 60s, the magazines, and now we're in this state where we're kind of going to that smaller audience again.
Well, I mean, it used to be that if you, like in the golden age of sci-fi, if you had a spaceship on the cover, you could sell that to a science fiction fan. That's really all you needed. I think that's one of the reasons that space opera came about, and it came about as a derisive term for a horse opera in space, because it was considered lowbrow. It was, you know, basically, as long as you had a spaceship on it, it could be any other story, but in space. So that was meant to be kind of a derisive way of describing it. And look at what happened to it now. Now, space opera is a great term that you have. It's no longer derisive. It is its own genre. And so people think of it positively rather than derisively. Now, it took 70 years to get here, you know, but it happened. Now, I think today things will happen a lot faster. They tend to snowball. And I honestly don't know where it's going to go. I think this is one of the, you'll see there's a similarity.
Yeah, no, space opera kind of took over everything in a way it still has. Not totally to the positive. I think it kind of lowered the intelligence level of popular science fiction. But then the Hugos, they did their part in that too. So, I mean, it's not just Star Wars and Star Wars wannabes. I mean, there's a lot of people to blame for that problem.
I mean, what is science fiction? That definition keeps changing too. And a lot of times it's very, everybody has their own very specific idea of what science fiction is. I know I do, and I don't know that a lot of people would agree with it. But, you know, it's that just kind of speaks to, yes, it's grown to the point where people want to redefine it, and they want to either apply it to their own thing, or its veneer, or take the good things from it and apply it to their own thing. Or they want to prevent other people from quote unquote polluting it, and I think that's a hazard of becoming popular.
It is. It is weird. I mean, even entering when I was an undergraduate in college, so this is the early Obama years. It still was pretty negative term to be considered a geek or a nerd. You know, there was still some social bullying at that part, and it was still seen as a more niche trend. But, you know, it's weird because sometimes I kind of long for those days, because these Dungeons and Dragons, you know, you could go to any table, or you go to the anime or sci-fi convention, politics never comes up. You know, it's not all that divisive. I mean, yes, grooming standards could do a lot better, not enough people are wearing deodorant, but all in all, a very welcoming place. And then we have this change in the 2010s where being a nerd all of a sudden becomes popular. And a lot of those same people that used to bully me, you know, now they're, you know, they kind of want to push you out and take your nerd hat and put that on their head. And so I don't think I'm alone in this I'm not sure if that was totally a positive change or not.
Well, I think there's a saying that says that success has many fathers, but failure is an orphan. And I see this, what you're saying, as a symptom of that. Once something becomes successful, everybody wants to claim it. They want to say that they're a father, that they had something to do with it becoming popular. If science fiction would have remained a failure, nobody would have wanted to do anything about it or with it.
Yeah, I was re-watching a documentary on the history of Doctor Who, because Doctor Who just had its big 60th anniversary. And they... the rise of popular science fiction at the end of the 70s with Star Wars basically is what killed off Doctor Who, because all of a sudden you had this huge icon, and then anything that the UK could produce, it just looked so shoddy in comparison. And that kind of was the death knell for that era of science fiction. I do wonder where science fiction goes from here. I'm not saying just this in a pot. You know, sometimes I'm a very negative Nancy. I'm a realist. I brought up Ayn Rand earlier. I have that problem. So not just the negative, but I mean, where does science fiction go from here? We're seeing incredible technology in front of us. I mean, general AI could really be a thing. I mean, we know that there's some truth, or at least very strong argument, you know, there's something to alien life. I mean, we're living in a very exciting time with the ideas of science fiction that we've dreamt about, you know, for 150 years. A lot of that stuff's coming to reality. How does that affect the fiction going forward? How does that, you know, change the audience for it? Do you have any thoughts on that matter? Oh, no, that was a little on the broad side.
I think that in some ways, when science starts to snowball and things start to happen fast, it's very hard to be a science fiction writer, because what you wrote, it might take you a year to write a book. So if I was to write a book about something that's trending now, I'm taking a great risk as a science fiction writer in that by the time it comes out, it takes me a year to write. It takes Bain another year or two to publish it. Now we're 3 years out. What I may have chosen to write about, especially if it's near future, could already be, you know, have made obsolete or whatever. Now, as far as generative AI rather than artificial general intelligence, I think a lot of people confuse generative AI with artificial general intelligence. Artificial general intelligence would be something along what we think of as AI, in that it has thought processes similar to a human being. And we're not there yet. What we're dealing with right now is nowhere like that. I think we're looking at another 100 years before we get to artificial general intelligence. But generative AI has done a very good job of fooling us into thinking we're talking about artificial general intelligence. I see people saying things, you shouldn't discriminate against something that's AI generated, and they somehow tie it in with Lieutenant Commander Data on Star Trek. And I'm like, what?
Yeah, that sounds like an argument you would see on Twitter. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Or Facebook or something. And I'm like, what? What? And it just, so I think the readers are expecting more and more advanced technology, which is actually harder and harder to relate with. And that's one of the things about making a good story. You have to have a relatable character, especially a relatable protagonist. And when you take the risk of writing something truly unique or truly strange, you risk not being able to capture a reader because they cannot possibly relate to something. So one of the examples I like to give is, if I was to write a story about the broccoli people of Brassica 4, how well could you as a reader relate to a piece of broccoli?
This sounds like it's going to be like a children's book or a piece of satire. I would read it though.
But they like hot butter baths. So it's finally gets it. It's one of those things that you as a science fiction writer have to take into account, is when you are creating these new worlds and these new technologies and you're leaping forward, that you don't leap too far forward so that people cannot relate to it. But at the same time, you don't stay too close to the present, because by the time your book comes out, it may have become obsolete or it's yesterday's news or whatever. I think that's one of the challenges of making good science fiction today.
Yeah, it's just a weird time to be an artsy person to work in fiction in general. I think the quality standards have slipped in a lot of ways. Like the Hugos I mentioned just briefly, but just like what's considered popular and good has shifted. But I think it's shifting back, because I think I see things like the fall of Disney, the MCU. I think people are beginning to recognize there's a major problem with, for some reason, maybe they can't put their finger on what's gone wrong. You know, that's why I think a lot of the arguments about wokeness, it's really just a way to say that something has gone bad. whatever thing has happened, you know, I get an inkling that maybe the companies, maybe the publishers, the people who are the gatekeepers are learning, and I'm hoping maybe things shift back, but I could be wrong. What gives you hope about science fiction? What do you love about science fiction? Are there people that you really enjoy reading today? Like, you loved reading Highland in the past. Who are the authors you look forward to reading now?
I think probably my favorite author going into these days is Lois McMaster Bujold. She did the Borkosigan saga. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It's space opera. It has the military SF component, but it more importantly just has a really, really great character. And I really enjoyed the Babylon 5 series. I was kind of hoping that they would make a comeback. And again, one of the reasons I enjoyed that is it had really, really great characters. The storyline didn't have a lot of messaging. I didn't sit down with it and think, oh, okay, now I'm going to be preached to. Or the only reason they asserted into this character, that they asserted this particular kind of character into the story was to tokeneer, you know, to have a token kind of character, or this is a token storyline. It did a little bit, but not most of the time. So for me, it's really characters that define it. You give me a great character and give me a reason to suspend disbelief, and you know, I can handle pretty much anything, including stuff that maybe has some sort of messaging in it, because it's all good stories need to have a message, not necessarily messaging. So those are the kind of things that I look for. So for me, the things that kind of push me out is just things that are mostly plot, that you don't really have good characters to carry the plot. But as long as you have great characters, I'll read pretty much anything. And it's one of the reasons I read across genres. I read pretty much everything but mysteries. So I read thrillers, I read romances, I read historical fiction and alternate. My taste really is about characters and good writing.
So you definitely buy into the idea that a good writer comes from a very well reader, very well read reader. Thank you.
I think so. I mean, writing is not the opposite of reading, but yes, I think you have to have that information kind of sitting in the back of your mind. You have to enjoy reading, and you have to enjoy stories, and you have to enjoy just the active process that is reading. So it's different in that it's not like TV or where it's just kind of your passive recipient. But with reading, you have to be a more active participant in the process. And I think all the people that are hooked on that kind of thing got hooked on it at a fairly early age and just continue to read through adulthood.
Yeah, and thankfully, it's not a situation where it's with comic books, where they've unfortunately they've gone so long in a quality drought that it's pushed away most of their normal readership and they went elsewhere. People who are interested in your military sci-fi mush are still interested in that. They still have people they can gravitate towards. You have an audience base that is there, wants to be there, versus comics, which is making stuff for basically an audience that no longer exists.
Mm-hmm.
Having your time now as being an author, where do you think it's going to go from here? You're obviously still interested in writing. Do you are going to continue working on this book as a series? Because the last three books you did were a series. Or are you going to try your hand at different genres? Since you mentioned that you read across the spectrum, maybe you want to try your hand at fantasy. Bane does fantasy books now and then.
I know they do. But going back to having to be a reader in order to write, since I don't consume a lot of fantasy, I think that would be a bigger learning curve. So I am going to stick with science fiction, at least for now. I might do urban fantasy because that's easier, but definitely not epic fantasy. I just don't have the background material for it. I had written Threading the Needle in a way that it's a standalone story. So it's a complete story, beginning, middle, end. No cliffhangers. But I did leave myself open to expanding it, perhaps with a different protagonist. So I think it could use a sequel. it kind of all depends on how well it does initially. My Ravages of Honor series was always meant to be a series, and I don't know how long because I'm a pantser, so I have no idea what I'm doing most of the time as far as what I'm plotting out. It just, the story just like just kind of flows out of whatever I happen to be doing. So even though I planned it to be a series, I can't tell you that it was, it's going to be a
series. So you say pantser and you mean by the seat of my pants or you're winging
it?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Thank you.
I mostly ride by the seat of my pants. I know where I'm going, but I don't know how I'm going to get there. And there's about four or five other books that have been kind of hanging in the background, kind of begging to be written sometimes, and sometimes going, no, we're not cooperating, we're not talking to you. So basically my imaginary friends aren't talking to me and I can't do anything about it. But they're mostly science fiction, probably something on the hard SF side.
Okay, that's fair. Some artists do, or they're, you know, it's like the sculpture is inside the stone. You know, I'm not truly the artist. I'm just unveiling it to the world.
That's right. You can just see me with my chiseling hammer, right?
We'll start wrapping this up. I appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today. Do you still communicate a lot with your family? Do you have family relations still out in Romania? Do you ever think about, like, where would my family and I be if we had decided to stay on the other side of the Atlantic?
I don't even want to think about it, to tell you the truth, because at the time that we left, things were so terrible. And I have a short story that I wrote, Pretending to Sleep. It's in my catalog that kind of deals with that a little bit. And in a lot of ways, I'm glad that we really don't have a lot of people that we had to worry about leaving behind, because we didn't know at the time that it was 7 years before the revolution. We didn't know there was going to be a revolution and that it was going to end well, because a lot of revolutions don't. I think at the time, if we were thinking anything with if we had anybody left behind, the revolution would take them out the same way that the Hungarian Revolution was quelled. So it, for me, I am just glad to be here in the United States. I am glad that my kids were born here and that they will never have to know any of the things that happened to me when I was living in Romania. So I am just incredibly grateful that my kids were born Americans.
Well, I'm grateful you came over too. My younger brother served Mission Romania. It was quite an eye-opening experience for him. You know, just to see the remnants of the Soviet architecture. You know, you have these huge blocks of these just industrial gray concrete apartment buildings. I mean, and it's still quite a bit of poverty and a lot of issues. I think at one time when they were trying to help people out, they found a man that basically lived in a closet. I mean, like not even like a nice, like upper middle class closet, which, you know, like a small one. But that was his life. That's what he had. And, you know, the people that had memories of the time under Ceausescu, and I'm sure I said that wrong, the dude was crazy. So not a lot of people seem to miss him. That was about the only thing everyone seemed to have in common, Romy, was they were glad that part of time was over.
Yeah, and it came at a very heavy price, you know. But I think once you get people to the point of desperation where they have nothing to lose, this is what happens. And apparently, every dictator needs to learn that the hard way, or just about it, I guess. I mean, probably not historically accurate to say that, but you know what I mean.
Well, I thank you for taking the time to come on the show today, Mona Lisa. This was an interesting conversation. It's a good book. Everyone should check it out, Threading the Needle by way of Simon & Schuster. You can find that at Barnes & Noble, wherever else good books are sold, or just like order online like everyone else does. Tell us a little bit about where we can find you. Do you have a blog? Do you have social media? If people are interested in learning more about you, where can they go to find that out?
So it turns out I have a website, MonaLisaFoster.com. I am also on social media. And when you look for me, Mona Lisa is one word. So my books are on Amazon. I'm on Facebook and Instagram. And on Twitter, I'm at House Dobromil. rather than, but I think if you put my name in, you can still find me. My website is mostly about, concentrates mostly on my Ravages of Honor series. I do have a store there. I also have a Substack. Mostly there I blog about the writing craft, but every once in a while I will blog about life in Romania. So my Substack has several sections. If you want the writing one, it's called So You Want to Be a Writer. And if you want about stories about living in Romania, then it's called, that's really the Pretending to Sleep, I guess, channel or section of my Substack. And I think it's monalisafoster.substack.com. But you should just be able to put my name in and find me, because I think I'm the only Mona Lisa Foster on there.
Yeah, I don't know a lot of authors that go with first name Mona Lisa. That makes you pretty unique.
It's not my choice. It was just what was given to me.
Okay, last question, then we'll end here. What's with the sword? With all the pictures I see for your author, it's you holding the sword, which I think is fun. I think swords are cool, but are you into fencing? Do you just like swords? What's the story there?
Yes, I like swords. So the story is, my kids were taking karate or martial arts. I think it was general martial arts at this school in Colorado. And I was already paying the family rate because my kids were there. And I would, you know, take them in like a good mom and just, you know, sit around. And while they're doing karate and I'm sitting around being bored, I'm watching these guys and they've got their hakama and their kendogi on, and they're beating on each other with bokens. And I'm like, ooh, that looks like fun. So the dojo owner said, you know, you're on a family plan. You could just like join their class. And I'm like, okay, let's do that. It turned out what they were teaching was Japanese military toyama, which is something that came out of World War II that they taught their officers, or it was before World War II. So it's not necessarily everything that a samurai would know, but it was like very practical, quick and dirty methods of using a sword on someone. And it happened to also be the root for a lot of the stuff in Star Wars. So a lot of the choreography that you see with the Jedi with their lightsabers came out of the same school or the same thought. So of course I'm going to join this class, right?
That sounds awesome. I wish I could attend this class. This sounds great.
I mean, it's different than Aikido or they have one where they have the bamboo swords. But because in this class, we actually use bokens and then a padded sword, but it's that specific military rule that came out of World War II that was meant to be a quick and dirty instruction for their officers. So even though they have some of the ceremony that goes with it, it's not as historical, I guess.
Okay. And then you just submitted that picture to like the book publisher?
That's the picture that they chose. I sent them several pictures, and of course that's the one that everybody chooses. Because it's an actual sword, it can be used for tough cutting, so it'll cut through bamboo.
It's attention grabbing.
Yeah, and it'll cut you too, because I have this great scar here on the inside of my, on the webbing of my hand from resheathing the sword. Because of, you know,
ouch.
And apparently it's a rite of passage. If you don't have a scar there, you're not a real practitioner. And I have a scar.
Well, that is a good story. Well, thank you so much, Mona Lisa, for coming on the show. Everyone, please check out their book. We'll wind it up here, guys. This has been Culturescape. I'm your host, Peter Pischke. Thank you to Bain Book Publishing for helping support the podcast, the imprint of Simon Schuster, and of course, Young Voices, a journalism advocacy organization. And lastly, and most importantly, of course, all of you. Yes, the show couldn't be done without your viewer and readership and listenership. So until next time, my friends, keep geeking out.